Where were you and what were you doing when you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Well, it was on a Sunday afternoon, and I was attending church in Scotland, South Dakota, in the Bethany Reformed Church. And when it came out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they told us the news that Pearl Harbor was attacked and we were at war.
Now, who told you? Did you hear it on the radio or did some person tell you?
The person told us that. Yeah.
Now, did you volunteer for the services or were you drafted?
No, I was drafted.
Now, did you have any other family members that served during World War II?
Not close. I had an uncle. I had one uncle that served.
Okay. And what do you remember about your basic training?
Well, it was very regimented, of course, but I had the experience of army life because I was in the CC camp in 1937 and 1938, and we had barracks and very familiar formations, but no basic training, nothing that pertained to army.
Now, you mentioned you were with a tank unit. How did that happen? How did you end up in that particular unit?
After basic training, they sent me to school at Midwest Automotive Mechanic School in Bloomington, Illinois. And it was a 12-week course on automotive mechanics. We were instructed, and the school was all civilian, and we lived in hotels. And of course, Bloomington, Illinois at that time was State Farm headquarters, and I imagine there was maybe 1 or 2,000 girls there. It was just, a lot of women working for State Farm at that time because the men were, doing other things. Later on, they sent me to, after we were in Tennessee maneuvers in the fall of 45, I was sent to Flint, Michigan, to General Motors School of Technology on a diesel engine. It was a two-cycle, six-cylinder diesel that was used in the tanks and in tank destroyers.
Now, when did you ship out overseas?
It was February, I would say about the 8th to 10th out of New Jersey for England.
Do you remember the name of the ship that you sailed over?
It was an English ship. We said it was a Lyman ship, And we were North Atlantic, of course, at the time of the winter was usually pretty stormy, but we went over very smooth. But when you went out, all you could see was ships, and they were all spaced about so far apart, and they weren't moving very fast. Of course, in a convoy, you can only move as fast as your slow ship. But we would see these destroyers coming around, it's just going like everything. And we got over to Cardiff, Wales, and it said the largest shipment of troops and supplies came over in this convoy. There was 600 ships in that convoy. So it was a big operation.
Now, where were you stationed during your time in England?
Well, it was at a base where we worked on tanks. We fortified tanks that were going to go into combat. They found out that in Africa that the tanks were vulnerable in certain spots, and they were fortified. What they'd done, they added another piece of armor in certain places on the tanks.
Now, you told an interesting story earlier today. I hope you can repeat it about how you figured out when D-Day was happening, June 6, 1944.
Well, we happened to draw guard duty to guard a certain area. Of course, we had to guard this certain old castle, English castle. And my duty was from from about 8 o'clock on till 8 o'clock in the morning, these 12 hours. And about 11 o'clock or so, I noticed these C-47s going over. And I knew that these were paratroopers because I was stationed at Fort Benning, Georgia for almost a year. And this is where the 82nd and the 101st Airborne troops done their training. They had jump towers. They had three jump towers down there where they done their training. And after they had so much training, they would go on these C-47s. And the reason that they went in a formation of three, one in front and two in the side, they were flying at night, and they were the middle plane, the front plane, was the only plane that had night navigation. So if he was wrong, the other two were wrong too. And next morning, of course, we got into the camp. They said the invasion had started. And the thing, you know, later on, it amazed me that there was over 2,000 ships that took part of the D-Day operation. And of course, the two places that Americans went in was in Omaha and Utah Beach. In Normandy Peninsula of France. And one of the problems with a high casualty list on D-Day was at Omaha Beach, because that fortification had never been knocked out. It was supposed to be knocked out because they had big naval guns, 16-inch naval guns, bombard these forts, fortification. And so they sent an airplane over to bomb this fortification, but they didn't use penetration bombs. They had contact bombs, and of course these contact bombs exploded when they hit the cement, that 6-foot cement. It didn't destroy these fortifications. And when the D-Day, these troops came in on these barges, they were sitting ducks. That's why the high casualty that was at Omaha Beach.
Now, did your unit get shipped off to France after D-Day?
Yes. What happened, Patton's army, you know, he was in tank. He was having trouble in France because, as I mentioned earlier tonight, the hedgerows. In Normandy, where Utah Beach was, on St. Mary Galice, all the farming fields, every field had these hedgerows, and they were 4 or 5 feet high, and they were with stone and dirt, and then rose bushes and stuff. You couldn't get through them. You couldn't walk them. They were that tight. And of course, road crossings, why the Germans had all had them zeroed in with their 88s. So he could not travel on their roads. So they had to invent a tank with a dozer blade on to poke holes in these hedgerows, so they could go around these fortifications. And they encountered some heavy tanks. We only had medium tanks that weighed 30 ton with 2.5-inch armor. And the Germans had a heavy tank, they call Panzer III tank, that had 4-inch armors and it weighed 60 ton, almost twice, no, I mean 50 ton, almost twice of what ours were. And the Patton's M4s only had 75-millimeter guns on them. They had 32 tanks in England that had 105s guns on them, and Patton wanted them. And tank platoon on our company, which I was a member of, the 32 guys volunteer to bring over those tanks, and we brought them over on the 22nd of June, about 16 days after D-Day. and they were used then by General Patton after we brought them into France.
Now, did your unit have to make adjustments to other tanks in order to modify them to fight in the hedgerow country?
No, no, we didn't. They had, the armored division had their own specialist repair people that could modify these tanks. No, we had no modification. We only repaired them, you know, like we replaced motors or transmissions, something like that. Once in the Great War, we did have to bring some back that had been hit, you know. But usually, after a tank's been hit, it was just about destroyed. It was about eliminated for any services, for any use.
Now, did your unit have to be on the move with the Army to keep up with it as it advanced through France? Or
no.
Was your group or your unit more stationary as far as its assignment?
The rest of my unit came over in July 11th. And then we start working with loading ships. I loaded many, many ships with tanks. So what we did, we went out with what they call ducks, the Army it was a vehicle that could go on the road and go on in the water, and then we would go out in there and we would work in these ship that were sent over with tanks, and we had to start these tanks and down in the hole. There might be 7-8 tanks down in the hole. We had to prepare them so they'd start them, because they were all cased up in cosmoline, and so they wouldn't get any salt air. The reason we had to start them up, because the crane would lift them out onto a ramp, and they would take them into a port, like in Cherbourg, at a dock, and they would have to start these tanks up and run them off the barges, actually what it was. And our company then run a motor pool. All these tanks that had to be run into these motor pool and all had to be serviced, made ready for combat.
Now, what was perhaps the most traumatic moment of your time in the European theater?
Well, something that I wasn't involved in directly that affected our company the most. I was on detached service. with the engineers. We built two bridges over the Rhine. One was a Bailey bridge, which was wood and iron, and then the pontoon bridge. They were about a half mile apart between Dusseldorf and Cologne. And we had 10 of our men from our unit went there to service a tank at the end. The Army had what we called a secret weapon. They had a Pershing tank, which was a World War I tank, that had a turret that only turned 28 degrees, but they took out the gun and they put in a 24-inch arc carbon light. And they run it from this radial engine. It was a Pratt Whitney, I think, 11-cylinder engine, because radials always have uneven cylinders. They run a drive shaft, they run a generator, and with a generator they produce electricity for these our carbon. We could light up 1 mile, you could read the newspaper, and we lit up the river so the Army engineer could intercede anything that would be coming floating down the bridge around the river to knock out this bridge. So that was our job for at least 3 or 4 weeks, to maintain this tank so it would operate during the night.
What was perhaps the funniest moment or something that happened during your time out in the field that just kind of made you and your buddies just laugh out loud?
Well, if you know anything about GIs there, you know, always like to look around for there's some activity. We got noticed at Dusseldorf. This is where the municipal wine cellar was for that city. And when they started bombing Dusseldorf, where it was a rural, very industrial city, where Cologne was more or less for arts, and it didn't have any industry at all. But it was completely burned out. They firebombed Cologne, and of course, Dusseldorf, they used explosives. The Germans, of course, they love their wine and stuff. Because in the hill country, along the Rhine and stuff, that's wine country. You get up into the Munich area where it's flat, barley country, that's beer country. Well, they moved their wine cellar across the river to the west in a little town called Mies. And they stored them in kind of oldest buildings that no one would suspect there was anything in there. And we found out about that, so I told the lieutenant, let's go up there and see whether we can bargain for any this wine. Being I could talk a little German, we drove up there and I said, where's the Bürgermeister? Go and see the Bürgermeister. And what do you want? Well, we'd like to have some wine. So I said, we want like a 5 gallon of white wine, 5 gallon of red wine. And he says, so how many men are you? Oh, we're quite a few men, you know. He had to be sure that if he gave any wine out, that had to be so many, many people, you know, a soldier. So we gave him a few packets of cigarettes and some chocolate. So he gave us a can of white wine, red wine. And when I got back to the company, I told our service officer, I think I can get some wine for the whole company. Well, we could use it, you know. So we went up there with a 2.5-ton truck and a 10-ton wrecker, because these wine vats were all 500-gallon wooden vats. And he had maybe 35 or 40 of those vats in his building. And Buchenmeister says, well, you got to have some verification for men. Well, we had 235 men in our company. Oh, he said, I can't have you have a whole barrel of wine for that many people. You got to have more people than that. Well, we said, I'll see what I can do. So he went back to battalion headquarters and got a certification for 800 men. We took it up there and we loaded this big vat of wine into this truck, 2.5 truck, and took it back to our company. And about a week later, we left for France, went back to Marseille. And we took this vat of wine with us as our refreshment. But what happened was, I guess the mayor maybe had the last laugh. These guys start drinking a little, and a couple of pretty some boys, they get a headache from it. It's so strong, and what kind of wine is it? Well, I rolled a tarp back, and it said, Krankhaus wine, hospital wine, 26% alcohol. So it was really for the hospital, not for enjoyment.
Where were you when you heard about the surrender of Germany?
Well, we were, in Germany, but it was not a day that we just made a big deal out of it. It's a funny thing that even when the war ended in Japan, we only got a half day off. That's all we got off, and we didn't get any time off when the war ended because of the fact orders didn't stop. Our company moved down into Marseille, France, and we had a motor pool, everything that came from Germany, with all the troops, and there were millions of troops over there, whether they had tanks or whether they had guns or whether they had jeeps or trucks. They all had to leave them there, and they went on a ship, and they were going to the CBI, and we had to put motor pools up, and we were busy almost day and night, you know.
When did you finally get back to the United States after the war?
Well, I think it was about the 13th of December. when we come out of the Mediterranean and run through the Rock of Gibraltar, and we ran into the Atlantic. I was on the Victory ship, the only ship around, you know, nothing else. It was like a sea of glass, and all the ones we run into the North Atlantic, and this was in December. And we were in a storm for 6 days, day and night. And we were supposed to land in New York and landed down in Virginia. And it was a, really a difficult time because it is, there's no let up. And I got sent then to St. Paul, Camp McCoy, to be discharged. And then it took a train home. And I wrote an article that went into the paper, Train Becomes a Way of Life, because I left Yankton to go into the Army on a train at Yankton Depot and on a train in Fort Crook and went to Camp Robinson on a train. And I went on a train to Dunedin, Illinois, and then down to Fort Benning, Georgia, then back home for a furlough in the summertime, and then back again. And then I went to Flint, Michigan on a train and back. And then from Fort Benning up to New Jersey on a train. And then we got over into England, it was mostly all by train. And when we got back, it was train again. So,
what was the toughest thing to readjust to life back in the States after the war? What was the strangest thing to get that you had to get used to doing again once you got back home?
Well, in the Army, you always had men around you all the time, 24 hours a day. You were sleeping with them or you were working with them at home. I was, you know, I was alone, really. Of course, I had my father and mother, but, you know, you didn't have this comradeship. You were lonely for your buddies, you know. You get to know better your brother. You sleep and eat with him for days and months, and you know him very well.
I've heard some veterans say, especially some prisoners of war I've read about, that one of the toughest things they had to get used to back home was actually the sound of a female voice because of what you said earlier. They were around men in the service, you know, all the time, working night and day. Was that also something that was a little strange hearing?
Well, not necessarily because, you know, we were in Europe and it was kind of our own culture, you know, the English and the French and German, you know. We got to mingle with civilians. Now, in Germany for a while, there was a restriction on you. You could not fraternize, what they call. I had the privilege of being able to translate. And a lot of times I had to do the translating, you know, where do we find a place to sleep for the night or which road to take or something. So I got to mingle a little bit more with civilians.
And how many other men in your unit could speak German at any level of proficiency?
Well, I was really the only one. We had one that went to college and took it, but it didn't really sit in, you know.
All right, thank you very much, Eugene Weidenbach, Scotland, South Dakota, World War II veteran. Thank you again for your service to our country. Steve Toon for South Dakota Public Broadcasting.